Welcome to Dungeons Demogorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're back for our Season 4B wrap-up. I think we can put Season 4 to bed now. Aaron, I hear that we just had a Vecna load.
Oh, man.
A whole upside down's worth of feedback this week.
It was clocks gonging. It was Armageddon. Real quick, if in case you missed it, Stranger Things is confirmed to come back for a fifth and final season. It will not be out until 2024.
Wow.
Is what they've said. So there is some interesting considerations in terms of, like, and the Duffers have confirmed there's going to be a time jump, which is discussed in feedback. So we are definitely getting more Stranger Things. We'll get one more installment and it'll be the finale. I think that feels appropriate. And we'll talk about the rest here in the feedback. Let's get right to it. Cause like you said, we got a ton. I was gratified to see that people were excited to see Stranger Things 4. A lot of talk preseason about how long it's been and is it even relevant anymore? And I thought this season overall was fucking rad, and it immediately rejuvenated my interest in Stranger Things. I feel like a lot of people said the same thing. It feels like really also Netflix might have learned a thing or two by separating the binge into two roughly equal halves of like 7 and 5 hours. Because like it feels like Stranger Things has kept in the conversation a lot longer this summer too. So sure. I don't know. Maybe something they're trying out. First up, John G in the old Stranger Things of baldmove.com mailbag. I don't know if this is true or not, but I always get the impression that the world of Stranger Things was not supposed to be our real world, but rather the world of 1980s movies. So, for example, when you say it's not impossible but not realistic for anyone to hack into school records in 1986, I think Ferris Bueller came out in 86, and in that movie there's a scene where he hacks into a school and changes the number of times he's been absent. And War Games directly referenced this season, Broderick hacks into his school to change his grades. It's the It's the Brodericks of the world that's always a problem here.
Yeah.
That was back in 83. Why is there a mall in Hawkins, even though there wouldn't be in real life? Because the mall featured prominently in many movies of the 80s, with entire movies being set in and around them. We talk of any of the Russians being tropes. That's because every Russian in the film in the 80s was a silly trope. So we see the Russians in the show. They're not real Russians. They're 80s movies Russians, which range from pure evil, sculpted from stone type guys to goofy Yakov Smirnoff types, etc. I think this is the best lens to look at this show, because you're right. Like, this is simultaneously small town America, but if small town America got to participate in all the things that movie culture was based on, which is kind of how as a kid you approach it. Like, you know, I guess I always knew that like Kevin's parents in Home Alone were rich, but you don't really kind of understand the difference in the way they're living until you're much older. In the exact same way that even though I lived in a cornfield, like I could drive to a mall 40 minutes away. So I knew I didn't have the mall rats experience, but I had it. Yeah, I like this. I like this a lot.
Sure. You're absolutely right about that. Here's one fly in that ointment. I don't even think the movies of the 80s were as diverse as Hawkins is depicted in the show. So that kind of falls flat. Like, certainly real life wasn't in the Midwest, but like even the movies of the 80s were not there.
So the other lens is it's 80s movie culture, but as if they filmed with today's sensibilities.
Right.
I think that's the missing lens. But thanks for pointing that out, John. Let's move on to Sean. In an episode where Max is under the Vecna spell in the cemetery and Nancy and Robin are escaping the institution, they jump over a feature in a landscape and a patient loudly and clearly laughs, ha, 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 ha. That landscape feature is called a ha-ha wall. And a ha-ha, also known as a sunk fence, blind fence, ditch and fence, deer wall, or fosse, is a recessed landscape design element that creates a vertical barrier while preserving an uninterrupted view of the landscape beyond the other side.
Isn't that most important, man? But
I thought that was cool.
I can't do it. I can't be an expert on all these things. So thank you for sending that information in, because I really love that fact. But there is no way I would have ever known that.
I feel like there's 15 people in North America watching, like some kind of obscure architectural landscaping nerd that like snorted when that happened. And that's my favorite type of Easter egg. Eric says, is Finn Wolfhard a poor man's Timothy Chalamet, or is Timothy Chalamet a poor man's Wolfhard? Oh boy. Finn, ooh, if you're listening, close your ears.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Finn is a generationally poor man. Like, his great grandfather was poor. His grandfather is dirt poor. His father was poor. He was born into abject poverty. Has no idea
of the taste of finer things. And then got redlined out of his neighborhood.
Yeah.
You can start listening again, Finn. We're done.
I don't think much of Finn Wolfhard. I feel like I've only seen him, and I've seen him in a couple movies now, and Stranger Things. He's got like one or two gears, and that's it. I don't know. I don't know that I'm buying Finn Wolfhard stock. I might be selling. Might be selling hard.
We'll see.
Timothy Chalamet.
Let's say unique looking people, interesting looking people. Take a look at Tilda Swinton. She's not conventionally attractive, but she's had a great career. So it can happen. Good luck.
You'll be fine. Just get a financial advisor. You'll be fine. Just from the stuff you've done alone, it's fine. Josh says, my main reason for reaching out, something has been in my craw since the very first scene of Hopper. I find the show to be a great period piece with a pretty good eye for detail, and yet here are some anachronisms there, here and there, but played probably for the rule of cool. That being said, the American flag patch on the police officer's arms are all on backwards. That patch is either for the left arm, because on the right arm it signals a retreating flag. An Air Force buddy of mine taught me about this years ago, and once you know it, you catch bad costuming choices every now and then. The flag should always be represented as a bear being the one holding the flagpole and moving forward, so the field of blue should always be towards the front. So he goes on and says that this might be a theory that the cops are working for the Russians, or the Hawkins has been co-opted. I gotta say, Josh, I don't think this is actually true. I think this is an Army, Navy, Air Force uniform code of conduct thing. And has been updated in the recent, I think, U.S. flag code. But I don't think this has at least always governed first responders, sheriff, police, certainly any other company. I've seen many times in real life, like paramedics that have the flag on quote unquote backwards, because if you think of, and I think this has come about as America has increasingly become militarized in our culture, and like police have become increasingly militarized. They've adopted that kind of macho, never fucking retreat, you know, blah, blah. Cause like, you know, can't have the old glory running backwards. But I think in mid 80s Indiana, I could easily see these guys having their flags on quote unquote backwards. Cause again, that is only ever true, I think, for the military. And that stuff changes. It's not set in stone. Like, it used to be a violation of the Uniform Flag Act to display the flag in any colors other than given. And now like frontline troops deploy with camo flags. So, So I think that's a recent development. I don't think it's an anachronistic, especially for like a small town sheriff's department. But, yeah, thanks for, because that's I do get that, I think, like once a season. Vernon says, I've been in the tank for this show since the beginning. This show created characters, showed you exactly who they are, dipped in 80s nostalgia, and allowed the characters to take the plot exactly where they needed to go. The children acted like children, the adults acted like adults, and rarely, if ever, did something occur out of left field for the plot's convenience. They achieved this in 40-minute episodes. I'm not in horror movies generally. Plot contrivances and cheap tricks designed to create suspense typically turn me off. Just like Game of Thrones is a fantasy for people who don't love fantasy, Stranger Things was horror for people who don't love horror. I fear they may be losing that. This season felt very bloated to me. The ridiculous Soviet Union rescue mission seemed out of place in the show in a lot of ways. The characters were charming, but the idea that three people are breaking to the Soviet Union military death camp, cannot escape with their lives, and two prisoners, really bothered me. Or they did do that. Sorry, the sentence was a little, I chopped it up a little messily. They spent a lot of time when everyone knew that Hopper and Joyce would make it back from Russia, and that the Murray's charisma would protect him at the very end of the show, at least. Papa's alive? How and why? Why would Vecna or One leave him to live? It seems cheap to me. Also, her powering up part of the show was very tedious. There were bright spots, but it definitely found me wanting. A lot of the California plot seemed to drag along as well. I found myself tapping my foot as the plot seemingly disconnected seem disconnected to the main action. I think it suffers from the fact that there just isn't enough for all the characters to do.
Can I admit a secret? I kind of agree with you on the L stuff. L has never been my favorite part of this show, except for maybe season one. Everything from then on has been like, well, I really care about the heart of this group. And if you Mike. Are not like, yeah, Mike, if you're not directly interfacing with the kids here and solving the problems with, you know, clever teamwork and board game analogies, tabletop analogies, then I'm probably not as excited about watching it. And this season was, you know, Elle separated from the group entirely, just doing her own thing in the upside down, void space. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not nearly as excited about that as I am everything that was going on in Hawkins and even, honestly, in California.
I do think I was a little bit more gripped up before the final two episodes because I was just so like, how the fuck are they going to get out of Russia in time? How are they going to get from Cal? It turned out that that didn't matter. Now, I do think that even seeing that or even having said that there is in that first half of season four some fluff and some fat that could have been trimmed. Some of that stuff felt repetitious, especially since you find out that they didn't need to. You know, they didn't need to escape. But I don't know, maybe there's something to be said for generating the suspense within the audience of how in the hell can they possibly finish with so little time and kind of doing it anyway.
I feel like the first Hopper escape attempt could have been excised entirely.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. Like there's a couple of those kind of things that didn't even really pay off because like it felt so good for him and Joyce to get back together in that final episode, but it would have felt just as good without all that background stuff. So I'm again like you're in pretty good company if you thought that there was pacing issues, Vernon, and if you thought the show's losing a little bit of its fastball, Alan Sepinwall, favorite TV critic, had very similar concerns. So I'm bummed that other people didn't like it as much as I did, because I've definitely been on the other side of that divide, and it always feels like you're the one with your nose pressed up against the glass looking in, you know. But And they're legitimate. I'm not saying that you're crazy for thinking that. It's just I thought the final two episodes were so strong that the little bit of impatience I had for what went before was kind of wiped away with pretty much universal delight.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and Dead 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Melanie said, I just finished listening to the episode 9 podcast. I was a little shocked that you didn't, I don't think you mentioned a very obvious Christ imagery in this episode. Vecna uses his tentacle network to pull L up into the most obvious Jesus on the cross pose in front of his door with the stained glass window. I know this was closer to an instant take than a full podcast, but after listening to your Leftovers and Westworld coverage, I was a little surprised it didn't even get a mention. Anyway, I'm already of the opinion that L was going to have to die to put an end to this once, so I think this is foreshadowing that L will have to fully sacrifice her life to destroy Vecna and fully restore the barrier between our world and the Upside Down. Yeah. It's tough to do an instant take style podcast for a 2.5 hour episode. But even still, I guess I consider this kind of Christ imagery to be like the Fisher Price of Western narrative techniques. And like, you know, if you read the Red Badge of Courage and your teacher pointed all these out to you in seventh grade, like, what do you need me for? To the extent I almost don't even need see him anymore. It's like, oh my God, so many cry. So I was like, I'm inclined to not, like, if you want to talk Nebuchadnezzar and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you want to talk like some deep biblical lore, I'm a little bit interested, but like wafers and cruciforms don't get me super, super narratively excited anymore.
Yeah. I mean, they can be the breadcrumbs that lead you down that trail, and then you can find more intricate and deep connections, but certainly.
What do you think of the theory that this is marking L for death?
I mean, well, let's be honest, you know, it's like saying a snake sacrificed itself for humanity, but all it did was shed its skin. I mean, come on, what are we talking about here? Jesus didn't die. Jesus simply shed his human body.
You know what? Hot biblical take, but that, yeah. This is right? This is a shell game. God's
there.
Playing.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
And if you're fully bought into the Trinity, then this is like really God playing shell games with aspects and shards of himself. Like, what
what are we talking about? But no, I take your point. Yes. Literally, certainly. I think this could be foreshadowing a sacrifice that she has to make.
Because the thing is like if she lives, then you've got like a girl who's got fantastic superpowers in the world. Like, to return the world to a normalcy, she would have to die or be depowered, which is only done through trauma. And I don't know that I want to see that again. So,
and if not, the Angelas of the world need to watch out because she's coming for them.
Yeah, more skates to the face.
Mm-hmm. Well, superpowers skates. Pop her fucking head if she could have. That's the thing. Skate to the face was the last resort of a depowered L.
Yeah, it seems like this show is unusually squeamish about killing these kids. Like, they couldn't even do Max. Uh-huh. That's the one thing that points me in the other direction. Maybe
we'll see.
Okay, Zach S., with the news of the recent renewal, the Duffers have recently confirmed that season 5 will involve a time skip that takes the remainder of the show into the early 90s. While this is exciting news generally, nice. And I can't wait to see how Dustin is dressed as a young adult still getting over the loss of his hair metal-loving friend this season, and hear some Nirvana in the soundtrack, you guys did a great job pointing out how, unlike previous seasons of the show, a ton was left unsettled and ended with a true cliffhanger. I agree that the show needs to start episode 501, picking up exactly where we left off at the end of 408. But how do you do that with the time skip? Especially if the kids are supposed to be high school freshmen in one scene and college in the next. I can see them making a mid-season time skip like the one in Fargo season 1, but that feels like it just introduces more problems and isn't nearly as satisfying as a full adventure arc taking place to end the one last new version of Hawkins. But they also can't come back to an unrecognizable hellscape 7 years after the end of season four and just explain the intermittent 7 year gap with exposition, can they? I guess Westworld is doing that now with the whole Robot Wars questions, but that's a different kind of show. What are our thoughts on this?
And if we're talking about Robot Wars, is there going to be a upside down war that's going to happen? That's going to keep the upside down at bay for 7 years for Hawkins or what?
The only thing I can think of is they're like, Hawkins is fucked in the same way like that one Pennsylvania town that's coal mine caught on fire made it inhospitable, but it's going to be chalked up as additional seismic activity that's fucked, uniquely fucked this Indiana town, and it's going to take 7 years for the Vecna to perfect his plan because he did get Max, but I think he got enough to open the portal, but it was like not his full plan in execution.
I think you're right.
I think that is what they're going to hang on, but I think the Duffers are in a little bit of a problem because I think they sold a lot of the audience like, oh God, the gates of hell are wide open and there's not but Elle and her friends here in Hawkins to help close it. And that's not what we're going to get. The other thing is like, I wonder if they filmed just enough footage to do an episode for next season where the kids can like hastily do some kind of portal patching and return to some sense of normalcy. But I don't know, man. Hawkins looks fucked, like way more fucked than they were the night before when Elle managed the partially close the portal, I guess.
Yeah, and it raises a ton of questions about how is this group going to stay together in any meaningful way? Like, if Mike's family needs to move out of there, out of Hawkins, I don't know, his dad didn't seem to be too worried. But like, if they need to move out and Hopper needs to move out because Hawkins is just uninhabitable, they're not all going to the same place. They're going to scatter across the country. So like, I don't know. They did it this season. Maybe they can do it again where it'll feel interesting to have these kids scattered across the country or bring them together somehow. I don't know. We'll see. I really think next season, you know, Time Jump or Not is going to be about the search for Mad Max, right? She's lost somewhere in the void. Elle's gonna have to find her before Vecna does.
For seven fucking years, she's gonna be in a goddamn coma while the Earth is plunged into hell. That's the other thing that makes no sense.
Yeah, 7 years of coma is a lot of coma.
I gotta say, I think it's ballsy for the Duffers to set this challenge in front of them. But man, I don't know. I wonder if the better thing to do would just be to get Netflix to film two seasons back to back and be done with it. Because like, yeah, I don't. This feels much more like, you know what? COVID fucked us, and these kids are now 5-6 years older than we need them to be, and we're bowing to that reality rather than this is how we always intended it to go.
Yeah, but I will say this is a great development for the soundtrack, though. Like, I love 80s music, but I want to see Stranger Things do 90s music just as much. So bring it on.
Yeah, that is an exciting prospect. And the other thing is, like, I thought when I saw 2.5 hour finale, 90-minute penultimate episode, that the Duffers have lost their fucking minds and there's no way, and I was dead wrong. So I'm done with doubting them in advance. We'll see how it goes. E-Man, I read online that they haven't started filming last season yet, so I highly doubt they'll pick up right after this season. They're already looking way too old for just starting high school. Will's aged a decade. Jonathan's like 45 now. I think they'll do it 3 years later and go right to the end of 1989. Maybe do it right at the new year. That could be fun. A fun way to enter the 90s in style. Could also line up nicely with the 2024 New Year's Day release date. And it would be fun to be back in the winter again. So we're finally going to expand. So I think that's a cool idea. Actually, I think that's a really cool idea. Releasing this like at the tail end of Christmas break. Although if you want to do that, release it at the beginning, like release it mid-December for all the kids off at school to like binge Stranger Things.
I would like to see them all be 21 of drinking age in the next season. That might be fun. But we'll see.
Yeah, Elle drunk seems scary.
Just like the first time getting drunk is an experience for kids, right? So,
yeah. And
granted, you don't need to be 21 to do that as a kid. Certainly, most kids get drunk before 21, I'd say.
So we're finally going to expand way beyond Hawkins now and have worldwide stakes. I'm thinking most of the USA or even the world will be affected by the death virus or whatever they're going to call it. And Eleven and Dr. Owens will be at the forefront of the fight with only top government peeps. We'll definitely bring back 08 or 008, Chicago Girl. Did any of the other kids survive? If so, we can have a super group going. They're going to be training and everything. You know, if they go this route, having an entire season seems like too much. Maybe we'll just have a 2 or 3 giant episode finale. A trilogy of movie episodes seems intriguing.
Sure.
Because, yeah, that's the thing. It's like there's no guarantee we're going to get like the length of... although I thought the Duffer said that they were planning on season 5 to be the longest one yet.
Wow.
So I don't know. Where are you with... I think that none of the other... In fact, I don't even know how 8 made it out because I thought that the story they told was 11, the one slaughtered all of the kids except for 11.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I don't know how 8 made it out, but she did.
Yeah. So I don't think we'll have a super group.
That's a ballsy proposition for the starting of the season, like to make it hell on earth, like actual everybody has been overrun by the under or the upside down and like, you're fighting it back.
Yeah.
I feel like it's too late at that point, but maybe not. You cut out the heart of it. Who knows?
Ben wants to know, what's your all's opinion on the idea that one is, or Vecna is 11's father? The meta connection between Vader, Luke, and one and 11. The fact we don't know 11's father and one was this first one of the powers and all the other kids were born after him. Let me know what y'all think. Thanks for the great analysis. The ages line up. If he was 7, 8 in the mid 50s, he's going to be, you know, 17, 18 in the mid 70s. He's going to be in his mid 20s in the 80s. He could certainly have fathered children. And that's if you just keep it like, you know, not creepy, which I don't think you could guarantee Brenner wouldn't. There's that 1 in 11. You know, like that's like 1 and then 2 ones equals 11.
You complete me? Yeah. They have 0, 0, 1, right? So the 11 would make it all ones? I don't know.
Yeah. Isn't that binary addition too? If you have 0, 0, 1 and then 0, 1, 1 would be the, you know, the next numerical sequence from that.
It'd be 0, 0.
That'd actually be 2. Oh, would it?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right. Fuck.
I don't know, man. That sounds like a crazy theory, but it could be right on. I don't see any reason it can't be.
Yeah, and the Darth, yeah, that's like the villain that's secretly the father. Like shit, they played with that trope in The Boys this season. So we'll see. I don't like it, but I even like it less than the Brenner is her father theory. But it's only because one's a creep. So
yeah.
Donald says, I said in my last email, I have faith in the brothers Duff. They always seem to stick to landing, and damn it, they did it again. I will say this season and last felt looser than the first two seasons, and they definitely need a good editor. Yeah, I felt like 2 had a lot of fat in the middle. I thought 3 was a great season. Mm-hmm. I think this is a great season, but I have a hard time squaring that with my saying that this has some fat in it too. Mm-hmm. You know, like season 1 does, perfect. I think season 3 better than 2. I think 4 is better than 2, but not quite as good as 3 maybe.
That sounds
goddamn
right.
This finale was pretty goddamn great. Donald says, one note about Max. Brenner mentions that Henry sucks all of a person, everything they are, everything they is, out of them and has in them, making their power, taking their power for his own. To get Max back, they'd have to take Henry out. I think the implication is that Elle saved Max's body, but her mind is completely void. Not empty, but void, like the difference between null and zero in a database. I'm sure there'll be a plot point going forward. I almost forgot, is 8 coming back to fight at the Doom Portal? First of all, yeah, we've already talked about there's a couple of these theories that it's like Max isn't gone. She's been possessed by Vecna, and Vecna's either hiding in her mind as a refuge, or he's got Max imprisoned in his, you know, red realm. I just like, man, with the time forward jump into the 80s, 90s, I just like, that's a long time for a young person to be in a coma. Is Lucas going to be by her bedside
for 7 years,
6 years later, 7 years, whatever, later,
who knows?
Like, maybe he is, but that's an awful lot to ask a 15-year-old. His first love.
And are his parents going to let him stay there? Is he going to go to college? Are they going to move away? Like, Hawkins is fucked. Why wouldn't they move away?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. What do you mean at 8? Well, this second time it's come up. She's come up, rather. I never had a big problem with 8, and I kind of expected her to show up at the end of this, somewhere in this season. There's a school of thought where the brothers Duff are embarrassed by the reception of the New Mutants, and they're kind of like pretending, they're pretending it didn't exist.
Yeah, they should be, and that's the proper course of action. Don't repeat your mistake. Don't even flirt with repeating your mistake. Why would you?
It's weird that all this shit would happen. Like, so this is the first time this stuff has made it'll probably undoubtedly make national. No. Yeah, like, it's weird for me the 8's out there, and she sees what happened in season 3 and what happened at the mall, and that's all on the news, and then she never shows up. If she doesn't show up, then I think she's dead. Then the brothers Duff killed her.
Sure.
They murdered her. Let's move on to Josh. Said, I had to write this email because there's nothing that gives more joy than watching Nancy turn into a complete badass at the end of every season. There's a job that needs to be done. There's never a moment of hesitation from Nancy. She figures out what they need. She weapons up and she runs into the fray, ready to face anything and everything she can to save the day. We all talk about core characters all the time, but Nancy doesn't get praised often enough for having the brains, brawn, and bravery the group needs right when they need it most.
True.
Especially the last two seasons. I totally agree. Like, everyone talks about Steve being the dad or the mom of the group, but goddamn, Nancy, the mama bear, is getting shit done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's why I like them so much together at this point, because Steve is a total douchebag and they're both like badasses.
Like, for 7 years in the future, we're going to miss all the will they, won't they, the love triangle stuff. Like, that's some of the cool things, and they're going to have to just let go. Because there's no fucking way that they're still dancing around like that in 7 years. I don't know. Maybe it gives both of them enough to have a, but yeah, I just like, yeah, I don't know. Cause it's hard for me to believe that people go back to like real world and start, you know, going to college and getting married and stuff with the hell mouth open.
Right.
But the Duffers might roll that back and make it not as big a deal as it was. I don't know. Jim, I'm pretty sure that the opening of Sullivan's raid inside the bunker, he's talking about episode 8, is a shot-for-shot homage to Darth Vader's raid at the Tanta V in the opening of The New Hope. Did anyone else notice that, or am I way off base? I don't think it's literally a shot-by-shot or homage. But it's, and it's like, it's hard to say what's the line between an homage and just like army guys breaching a base. I've seen it a couple dozen times and all kind of, and it kind of looks all the same. So I don't know. I don't know. That definitely Star Wars is in the show's blood though, right? The other thing that's been bothering me is when in episode seven, the kids go to Eddie's trailer to try to extract the older kids from the Upside Down. The problem is the agency had already found the portal in the trailer. It doesn't make sense that the agency would have left it totally unguarded. You'd think that at the very least they would have stationed a few agents there to monitor it or something.
I think you're right about that. That's a little weird, which is why the one in the lake was such a good entrance, because who's going to know about that, let alone have people monitoring it?
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm trying to think if there's like a time crunch where they just have to find 7 or 11. They have to find 11 and they don't, they're a small like black ops team. They don't have time to post guards. So they just go for broke finding 11. And when they have her in her position or kill her, they assume the portals will close. I don't know.
Was it something where the authorities didn't realize that was going to be a portal because it was just like a scorch mark on the ceiling and then it opened?
Yeah.
Point.
I assume that they know everything that Brenner knows, though. It seemed like that they were well familiar with his work.
Yeah.
But that might be a little bit of a plot hole.
I'm not sure how much he knows about it. Like, I mean, the kids Out and Hawkins are all figuring this out, right? Does he know that there are four Brenner? Deaths and four bells and like four gates? Oh,
probably not at that level, no. But, you know, the knowledge of a gate and how it's open and how it behaves, and I figured he would know that, the Colonel Sullivan.
Maybe. I felt like this was something new that was not something he might know about, but who knows?
J Cubes wants to know, I know that the Russian gang went back to try to weaken the evil forces, but did that pay off on the screen in the struggle with Vecna? I don't recall Vecna noticeably reactive as they torched the Demidogs and the Demogorgon. Did I miss it? That's a good question. I don't know. There was never a point where like Vecna's choking the shit out of the kids or L or somebody, and then, you know, Hopper chops the head off a Demogorgon and like it distracts him or makes him like feel connected pain or anything.
So was the entire Hopper thing pointless? Was that entire excursion only to get Hopper out of the Russians' hands?
Well, that's what he said. He goes, I don't mind stories about ineffectual heroes. He cites Indiana Jones as like, you know, sure, all of his movies, like
you can, you take know, him don't, out and nothing matters.
Yeah, like God takes care of the Nazis. That's fine. the Grail took care of itself. So like maybe they're leaning into that. That like it's okay to have your heroes try and strive and ultimately don't amount to a hill of beans.
It's a lot of screen time to spend on something that doesn't amount to a hill of beans, though.
A lot of discussion about Will. The meta discussion about Will. Jonathan says, from a meta standpoint, the Will situation allows the show to introduce a gay character without having to introduce a new love interest at a time in a time of plot where that would be weird and feel a bit forced. I recently heard someone speaking on the matter to say one of the unique challenges of being a young gay person is that your first love is statistically very likely to be unrequited. I believe they're doing a great job depicting Will being in this exact same conundrum while also displaying his confusion, which is why it seems confusing to us as an audience. I agree with that, and yeah, that's an interesting point.
And I don't think the internet was as up in the air about this as we were. The internet's firmly like, oh, Will's gay and this is unrequited love and end of story.
Well, and we're very much
like, are they dancing this line or are they messing up? But
I was more of like, he's obviously gay. Why aren't they just moving on to the plot? But like, the next two emails are from some representatives of the LGBT community to talk about their Midwestern experiences growing up gay. Mm-hmm. First is Sarah. She says, I wanted to take a moment to try to provide some context to the scenes with Will and Mike, because those scenes made me ugly cry. I grew up in Anderson, Indiana, the meth capital of the Midwest. She's not lying. My mother-in-law lives in Anderson. They are a meth-aware community. There's signs on the side of the street where it says, we are a meth-aware. Like, and I always thought that's funny. Like, what the fuck? Are they trying to raise meth awareness? Like, they're just leaning into them being the meth. Yeah. No, it's notorious. Notorious. I was also raised as a boy, and Anderson isn't any different than the rest of the farm adjacent towns in Indiana. Very conservative, religious, bigoted, stuck in their ways, much like Hawkins is portrayed via dialogue from Robin about coming out to the wrong person. When I was around 13, I realized I liked both boys and girls, and this was not easy for me, as at the time I was in a Christian school trying to fit in by believing in Christianity. It's very hard because of the cognitive dissonance. I liked boys and girls, but all my teachers and authority figures at school were telling me I would burn in hell. Mm-hmm. Around 15 or so, I developed an incredible crush on my best friend at the time, Brian. The scene between Mike and Will in the van, with Will spilling his guts, only shading it behind the guise of L basically commissioned me to paint this, was absolutely heart-shattering to me, because I've had this almost exact same conversation hidden under the guise of being, this girl, ... All I wanted to do was tell him how I felt, that I thought he was cute and manly, and I wanted him to hold me and make me feel safe and comfortable. All I wanted to do is scream at him to kiss me and ignore the shitty girls being mean to him and fucking with his emotions. I wanted very badly to tell him how I felt, but that looming shadow of fear of hell and being an outcast kept it repressed and hidden. That scene is so fucking real because this conversation absolutely happens. Sharing your feelings vicariously through allegory and replacement people. I adored the scene. I think it's one of the most real, well-written and well-performed scenes in the entire show. And I did see a lot of that. Like, I felt like coastal gays, progressive living area, were like kind of frustrated and saw these scenes as backwards. And there was a lot of gays, youth from the Midwest and the South. And I think we talked about this, saying, no, this is representation for us, because it's still like this in a lot of areas of the United States. And that's a point well taken.
And I think Noah Schnapp kills it in that scene. He does not get enough credit for his acting, because he's been largely sidelined in this show. But when he gets some meat to chew on, holy shit.
Dude, yeah, Will is so underserved. For all of the plot swirling around him, they still have not found a great way to service his character, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Chris comes in and says ditto on all the stuff that Sarah said. It says, in your episode, you mentioned how you weren't sure if this confirmed the Will is gay theory or not. But as a former gay kid in the Midwest, I can confirm this is a definitive confirmation that he is gay.
Okay.
He was never talking about Elle when he was talking about how lost and how different she feels and how Mike helps alleviate those feelings. He was talking about himself, using Elle as a stand-in, like Sarah said, allegorically. Sure. While speech does apply to Elle, he was speaking from his own heart and confessing his feelings in a roundabout way. Developing an unrequited crush on your straight friend is sadly an all too common occurrence for closeted teens. And the second that scene started, my boyfriend and I immediately knew what was happening, and we both loved the scene as a result. I didn't grow up in Indiana during the 80s, but I did grow up in the early 2000s, Wyoming, and I cannot imagine the experience was significantly different.
Yeah.
He also had an interesting thing that I didn't pick up regarding Jonathan. He says, during the scene, Jonathan is watching the whole time in the rear view mirror, and I think he knew what Will was trying to say. Mm-hmm. The heart-to-heart scene where they're assembling the sensory bath in this pizza place was Jonathan's way of saying, hey, I know you're gay, but you're my brother, and I love you regardless. It's honestly a very touching scene for both me and my boyfriend.
Definitely, you're right. Yeah. I remember like seeing Jonathan looking in the mirror and going, okay, he's noticing this. And it makes a lot of sense.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Secondly, moving on to other topics, Ben T says the Russian prison had multiple Demogorgons and a smoke monster, but was made clear in Season 3 that they can't create portals in Russia, which is why they built a mall in Hawkins. So where did they get those Demogorgons to experiment on? Just wanted to see if you had answers for this.
Captured them and took them back? I don't know.
Dude,
where'd they get the fucking mist, whatever they called it? The shadow.
Okay. I think we do need answers to this, because it's already stretching my mind that they're smuggling American citizen out of the country as a whole bunch of clandestine army intelligence types. Mm-hmm. But that they got multiple Demogorgons and that smoke monster out in that whole fucking mess. The only explanation is a portal did open that connected them somehow, and that the Russians have been able to perfect that technology, because I just don't think it makes sense otherwise.
Yeah, could be.
And maybe that helps, like, to explain, like, the world going to shit quicker if they're going to go down that, like, kind of, like, Doom 2 Hell on Earth storyline. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, that is a bit of a seeming plot hole. Ben also says something that wasn't really covered in this episode was how important Will is to the Upside Down. Remember the date in Nancy's diary was the date Will got captured? They never really explained that this season. We had the fact that Will's mind flare sensor was going off. We are going to find out that Will, not L, is going to be the one to save the day, as clearly Will's character is going to be integral to the story.
I hope so. All this stuff with Will pay off, because, yeah, it's been a little... It's been necessary and important, but, like, pretty lackluster as far as his character goes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we are kind of out of time, and we got to most of the main points. There's a couple people had some theories for next season, but they were all sent in before we found out there's going to be a no time skip stuff. So I don't think they're going to be super applicable. And again, I got like a late stage Game of Thrones amount of email in the last week, and it's just, you know, we could have read this for 3 hours and not got it through it all. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate everyone that did send this feedback. I am very excited, but also very puzzled and confused about how season 5 is going to roll out with this the shape of the end of season 4. Mm-hmm. But I was a little bit of a doubting Thomas coming into season 4 that they'd be able to recapture the magic, and they did. So I'm going to have faith in the Duffers until we see that they shit the landing. So that's it. We got our marching orders. We're going to put this thing on cryo sleep for 2 years. If you've enjoyed Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve's takes on Stranger Things, I'm sure that they will be back to cover the last two episodes after we're done. And then other than that,
is out as of today, as of last night, actually. So yeah, check that out. And they'll be coming back with their finale and their wrap up in the next 2 weeks.
And if you like our coverage in Stranger Things, stick around. We got tons of great stuff. We're watching For All Mankind right now. We just wrapped up The Boys. Jim is diving back into Better Call Saul. We've got Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, and House of the Dragon coming out later this year. Just tons of stuff. Keep up with us on baldmove.com. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. And if you like what you do, what we do, and you like a lot more of it ad-free, check out support.baldmove.com. But otherwise, we for sure will be back 2 years from now to see the final installment of Stranger Things, Stranger Things 5. Thank you very much for listening. Loved having you as an audience. We'll see you in a couple of years. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.